The Middle East is on the brink. The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. Now is the time for maximum restraint.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres talking about Iran's first and major attack on Israel on Saturday, when Iran fired 300 drones and missiles at Israel through proxies. Air raid alerts went off in Israel. Many airports in the Middle East closed, flights were delayed, of course, and the airspace over Jordan, Iraq, and Lebanon was shut down. Most of these drones were shot down before they even reached Israel, yet this is a major escalation by all measures. But was it unexpected? Iran did this after Israel had killed several Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps commanders in Damascus on April 1st. Since then, Israel said it will respond to Iran's attack. Now we wait. What realistically will happen? Is this setting a precedent for a direct conflict between Israel and Iran? And where does the US come in exactly? This is Beyond the Headlines, and I'm your host, Nada Al-Taher. And this week, we're breaking down the current standoff between Iran and Israel with senior resident scholar at the Arab Gulf States Institute in Washington, Hussein Ibish. This interview was recorded on April 16. Hussein, Iran's attack on Israel was its first ever direct attack and came in response to Israel's own attack on Iran's embassy in Damascus, which killed several IRGC commanders, as you know. And although we know this is definitely an escalation, Iran seems to have done this in a way that was strategic. It gave some warnings to the countries over which the drones and missiles were flying over and seemed to have not caused any major damage in Israel and certainly no deaths. What do you make of all of this? What's your analysis?
It's very complex because it is without a doubt an escalation. Israel's attack on the embassy compound in Damascus was itself a huge escalation because they didn't just kill some members of the IRGC Quds Force. They killed the senior commander and his aides of the Quds Force who were directing the activities of groups like Hezbollah and Kataib Hezbollah and the Fatahoun Brigade and whoever was, and the Houthis to some extent, however much influence Iran has over the Houthis, which is obviously is there, but also is, you know, really limited compared to these other groups. The Houthis ignore Iran a lot. These other groups don't, can't. This was sort of the command center for Iran's involvement and the involvement of Iran's network in trying to help Hamas fend off the Israelis in Gaza, and maybe even more importantly, help Hezbollah prepare for a potential and indeed threatened Israeli attack on Lebanon, a major offensive that Israel keeps talking about in the later in the spring or in the early summer. And, either they are really preparing for that or they're doing a fantastic job of pretending to prepare for that. So I think the Iranians just felt that this was too much, it's sort of, you know, tantamount to the assassination of Qasem Soleimani, and that it was really, you know, a big blow to them, a serious blow. And that they had to strike back. So they did this unprecedented attack on Israel, which is itself a major escalation. However, you have to look at it, in its full context, which is that Iran telegraphed its punch in advance. They let European and Arab diplomats close to Washington know when the attack was coming, days in advance. They let them know the nature of the attack, that they were going to be using mainly drones, that they were going to be targeting military facilities and not anything else, that it was going to be in the hundreds of drones and things like that. I mean, really, like they gave them a kind of roadmap of the attack on Israel so that it could be transmitted directly to Washington and to Tel Aviv and West Jerusalem, where the Israeli leadership is. And, you know, they also used mainly cheap, disposable kind of, drones that were easily shot down, that are slow and cumbersome and, you know, not that difficult to thwart. They used a few ballistic missiles and a couple of cruise missiles, but it was nothing compared to what Iran could have launched at Israel, especially if they unleashed Hezbollah with its 150,000 rocket and missiles right next to Israel, with precision guidance that are really threatening and kind of terrifying to the Israelis. So I think they knew that most of this would could and would be thwarted. And I think they were expecting that. By the way, it turns out that mainly it was the United States that downed these drones and missiles. There were 140 of them, the Americans estimate, that malfunctioned and technical difficulties that were just useless. There were 160 that were dangerous. And of those, the vast majority were shot down by the Americans. The Jordanians shot down some. The Israelis got some with Iron Dome. The British and the French also were involved. And possibly other regional powers, we don't know. But that mainly it was the Americans who did this. So the Israelis, who think that their missile defense was entirely successful, need to wake up and realize that the Americans were the responsible ones. So the Iranians basically pulled their punch. They telegraphed their punch and they pulled their punch. So the fact that there were no deaths and very limited damage was, I think, to some extent intentional on the part of the Iranians. They could have done much more if they had wanted to. My sense of it is that they acted because of domestic political pressure, both from the public and from hardliners. And they wanted to be able to say, hey, stop criticizing us. We launched a direct attack on Israel. And they put on their TV images from Chile and Texas of forest fires and things. And said, hey, well, you know, we caused all this damage, which is not true. But it's enough to restore the self-respect and pride, national morale in Iran. And that goes for Israel as well. Because this attack is the exact opposite of October 7, right? It's something that the Israelis were ready for. It was an attack that they were able to easily defeat. Their military and their technology, sort of worked this time. And the Israeli public can now feel again sort of safe and protected and inviolable and in the safe hands of their country's authorities rather than stateless and defenseless and abandoned, as they did on October 7 and 8, and to some extent even October 9, when the Israeli military was struggling to regain control of southern Israel from Gaza militants led by Hamas. So it's the exact opposite. So both countries now have the opportunity to say to themselves, well, okay, we won. We restored our national morale. We restored deterrence. We asserted ourselves, and no one will mess with us again. And that, and this is where we've landed up. I think the Iranians deliberately created a situation where the Israelis could, if they wanted to, just stop here and say, "Right, everyone's a winner, yay!" And so it's up to them.
This seems to be a win-win strike, right? For two enemy nations, in a way, for Iran internally and for Israel internally. What do we expect Israel's response will be? Are we seeing something like a similar strategic strike where a message is being sent, but no real physical or human toll is caused?
That's a great question. So, yeah, I think the general thinking of sophisticated observers was that Iran would not really majorly retaliate against Israel because of the attack on the embassy compound and the killing of its key operatives in Syria. The thinking was, general thinking, my thinking as well, was that Iran believes that it has been winning strategically due to the Gaza war, that they have suffered very little because for them, Hamas is a kind of an on-again, off-again ally. They don't really trust Hamas because Hamas is a Muslim Brotherhood group, and they almost came to blows over Syria. And they cut ties for almost a decade after the Syrian uprising broke out. And so they're kind of on-again, off-again member of the axis of resistance, and it's really a marriage of convenience, and both sides know that. It's radically different from the
way that Hezbollah and the Iraqi Hashd-e-Shaabi groups and others relate to the Iranians and the Quds forces, a much more organic alliance. It's a much more vertically integrated one. So, I think we thought that Iran would take revenge, but in a time and manner of its choosing. Somewhere else in the world, it may be with deniability, some kind of an attack that, you know, did a lot of damage to the Israeli psyche, but could have been aimed at a soft target, could have been done by, a terrorist group, or maybe by, a kind of something happens somewhere to an Israeli diplomat or something like that. You know, and it's just sort of inexplicable, or, you know, there are exchange of accusations. So that was the kind of thing that was expected, because it was believed that Iran really didn't want to escalate. But obviously, there was sufficient pressure, political pressure at home from the public and from hardliners to do something dramatic, to assert Iran's power in the region, to restore deterrence. This is the word that both the Israelis and the Iranians are using, or, you know, effective equivalents, which is strike back hard so that you teach them a lesson so that they don't do this again. That's, you know, sort of what restoring deterrence means. It often boils down to vengeance. And very often it's about national morale at home rather than, you know, really sending a message to anybody else. So, you know, yeah, I think we were wrong about Iran. And right now, the real question is, again, will the Israelis want to escalate? Will they want to go further? And there may be pressure to do something similar and attack Iran inside its own territory. And they might do that. They could do something, again, as you say, just similar to Iran, where it gives the Iranians the opportunity not to escalate in return. That's possible. They could do something more dramatic, which forces Iran's hand, because their Israeli hardliners agree with the Iranian hardliners that Iran has been winning and Iran's network has been winning. And the Iranian hardliners' thinking goes further, that the only way for Israel to turn the situation into a regional strategic victory is to engineer a regional war that drags in the United States and produces the long-sought but not achieved American attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. I think there are hardliners in Israel who agree with that. So they've been looking to escalate. Now, the next step could be, as I was saying, something directly in Iran. So I think the great danger here is that the main Israeli response will be, right, we were thinking about attacking Lebanon, now we're definitely going to attack Lebanon. And this is where we're going to hit Iran hardest. We're going to strike at their trump card. We're going to damage and destroy their main weapon against us, which is Hezbollah. We're not going to tolerate the presence of this group on our borders anymore. We're going to drive their elite forces away from the border area up towards the Litani River. And we're not going to tolerate this missile and rocket arsenal with precision guidance in Lebanon. We're going to damage and destroy it, most of it, or as much as we can. And at that point, it's up to Joe Biden to stop them. He has stopped them. They've thought about doing this and prepared for doing this several times since the October 7 attack, beginning in early October, around October 12th. Defense Minister Yoav Gallant proposed an attack on Lebanon and discussed it seriously, and was pushing Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu to authorize this, which he almost did. And it was stopped by Biden, who said absolutely not. And there have been several other occasions where the Israelis have been on the brink of launching an offensive against Hezbollah, usually from the air. And Biden has said, nope, you're on your own. Don't do this. I don't want it. I mean, it's not like he can control the Israelis, but obviously they want American support. And if they're told in advance, you get nothing from us if you do this, and we'll be very angry with you as well. It's meaningful. So the thing is, though, this is going to be a major test of Biden's persuasiveness and leverage over Israel. And we'll see if he can do it, because I don't think at this point there's much else that can stop the Israelis unless they're bluffing. But it's looking increasingly like they're not bluffing. And I think if they want to hit Iran back very hard, they won't attack in Iran. They'll attack Iran's major weapon in Lebanon.
Hussein, you touched upon this in your previous answer, but I want to talk about it more specifically, primarily the U.S. role in all of this. A few weeks ago, the U.S. had actually vetoed a U.N. resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. Then it abstained from the vote, causing it to pass. And then it warned Israel against launching an operation in Rafah. And after that, we saw the U.S. actually downing the drones and missiles that Iran fired at Israel. But more recently, the U.S. said that it's not going to be assisting Israel in a direct attack on Iran. So what's happening there?
So what's happening is that the American policy on the post-October 7 crisis, or set of crises, is a better way of putting it, in the region, and the war in Gaza in particular, has been a policy of conflict containment. In other words, the policy has been to do everything to ensure that the war doesn't spread, because the conviction has been that whatever happens in Gaza can be managed strategically from an American perspective, that as long as the war doesn't spread to the West Bank and East Jerusalem or somewhere else, or especially into Lebanon, to bring in Hezbollah, which can then drag in Iran and the United States and just turn into a major regional conflagration, that the Americans definitely do not want, whatever the Israelis think. Well, even if Israeli hawks want it, there's virtually no one in Washington. I mean, only some real fanatics, but certainly for American strategic interests, it is absolutely unacceptable. So the policy has been to support Israel strongly in Gaza, and with some limits, but to support them. Partly for many reasons, but one of the reasons has been to position the United States to say no on anything further, to restrain the Israelis. It's not just a matter of restraining Iran and its network, or the Hezbollah or the Hashdash Shabi, or even the Houthis, who've been managed by this coalition in their maritime attacks in the Gulf of Aden and the Bab al-Mandab Strait in the Red Sea. It's been more, I think, a matter of restraining Israel. Because the biggest threat to escalation, which is the one thing the Americans don't want, the biggest threat to expand the war in a major, sustained way, to create a regional conflagration, take it to the next stage towards a regional war, the first major regional war in modern Middle Eastern history, is Israel and its threats to attack Lebanon. Because if there is a major Israeli offensive against Hezbollah, then, the circumstances, it depends what happens. But it's easy to create not just one, but many scenarios in potentially which could drag in Iran, the United States, many other forces, and create this kind of regional wildfire, not just brush fires, but raging sort of hellfire that the Americans fear and want to prevent. That's where we are. So I think the United States is really in this weird situation where it is its main partner, its main ally, Israel, that is really threatening its policies. And it finds itself largely in agreement with adversaries like Iran and Hezbollah that the war shouldn't spread. And that's a very unusual and very difficult situation where your main ally wants the opposite of what you do, or is the biggest threat to your achieving what you want. And your biggest adversaries actually want what you want. And in that sense, they are cooperating to some extent. That's weird, but that's the situation.
Hussein, thank you so much for joining us again. Your insights are always very welcome. And this is such a complicated and nuanced topic that you helped us break down. Only you can do that, really. So thank you so much for joining us. That's it for today. We're sure you're already subscribed, but just in case you're not, please remember to do so wherever you get your podcasts. This episode was produced by Arthur Edison, Da'a Farid, and I'm your host, Nadal Tahir.